is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grillion Bunker. Welcome one and all to the Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks. Glad to be with you as always. Joining me in studio, of course, is my zany cohort, my pallid young friend, Mr. Caleb Hanks. How are you, sir?
Hello. I'm good. I'm living the dream.
As am I. As am I, indeed. And Chris Hayes, I guess he went back to being a ghost. And folks at home, I just want you to know that when Chris isn't here, you know, let's just be clear. It's not because he can't be here. It's because he doesn't love you. Now, joining us in Hour 2 tonight, someone who you will no doubt love, however, is Alex Sakiris. He's the author of the book Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. He's, of course, the popular host of the Skeptico podcast. And this is going to be an interesting interview. Really looking forward to talking with Alex a bit about his views towards science, skepticism, and I think something that he and I really have in common, which is consciousness studies. We both study consciousness quite an awful lot, and we discuss it in our mutual written works and on our podcasts. So, in addition to being a great guest that I'm sure he'll be, he and I have corresponded a lot, and actually a good bit over the years, too. But Alex, he also wanted to begin, I think, by opening a dialogue on this sort of subject matter and get into that. And speaking of getting into things, before we get too far down this proverbial road, I do want to say a quick howdy to my brother, Race Hobbs, back in Master Control. How are you, sir?
How do, Micah?
I'm wonderful, of course. I'm marvelous, in fact. And as we will discuss a little later in this broadcast, I very well may be more blessed than the average bear. I would stop just short. No, I'll actually just go ahead and say I've probably got a guardian angel. But that said, getting into a little bit that's happening in the world of news, in Colorado, there is a pit bull who is being called Patient Zero in a plague outbreak. And that's the exact kind of plague that you are probably thinking of. Boy, I tell you, this is incredible. Now, a pit bull was at the heart of a rare plague outbreak in Colorado that left 4 people sick last year. And it's now been determined by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that this was the case, according to a report that was just released at the tail end of April. The CDC says on average about 8 people get the plague every year in the United States, and while it still can be life-threatening, with modern medicine, it is not the death sentence it was back in the Middle Ages when millions of people were killed by this. Still rather disconcerting to know that that people can contract the plague, and of course that, you know, your pooch might be the one who will give it to you.
Well, it's good to know that there is some sort of deadly disease floating around again, because Ebola just poof, gone.
Well, not so much. As a matter of fact, Caleb, actually, the latest on that has actually been that apparently those who are survivors of Ebola, this was in the news just the other day, those who are in, for instance, if you're a male, especially, they warn, who has been diagnosed with and then cured of Ebola, you may still actually carry it in your system, and you could actually transfer that to someone if you don't engage in safe sex practices. So that's what they're warning people. Please use protection if you are an Ebola survivor, because even while it doesn't register in your system, bodily fluids may continue to have that present, and you could still pass Ebola along to somebody else. Can you believe that?
The gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, Ebola. So it is actually still out there, just incognito. Is how they like to say it these days. Yeah. So anyway, now this pit bull story is pretty interesting. In last summer's incident, they say that what stands out is the possible human-to-human transmission, according to the investigation, and that hasn't happened in the United States since 1924. Earlier studies have shown that pneumonic plague, even its most severe form, can be unexpected, according to the local health department. The team that investigated the case said that they could only find one other case of dog-to-human transmission in the medical literature. That was a 2009 case in China. Yeah, so if you don't think that's scary, what about night terrors? Here's another one in the news right now. Young children who get night terrors could be at greater risk for sleepwalking later in life, according to a new study from Canada. Now, researchers analyzed information from about 2,000 children born in Quebec who were followed from age 5 months to 13 years of age. About half of the children in this study had experienced a night terror at some point between ages 1 and 13. In such an event, the child wakes up suddenly crying or screaming and is sometimes confused and drenched in sweat, which is what happens to Caleb, I'm sure, every single night, much to his girlfriend's enjoyment.
She likes him sweaty.
I suppose so. Some folks do. You know, as a matter of fact, speaking of sweating at night, I tell you, I just could not... As a matter of fact, several of the last few nights I have just been... It's not that cold, but, you know, warm outside. It's been quite cool, but I just sweat almost uncontrollably. It's quite quite interesting, but I digress. So now, this study with the children who experienced these night terrors, they say that those who experienced them before age 4 were nearly twice as likely to be sleepwalkers later in childhood compared with children who didn't experience early night terrors. Overall, 34% of kids with early childhood night terrors sleepwalked later in life, whereas 22% of kids who didn't have early night terrors later sleepwalked. The study also found that if parents were sleepwalkers, their children were more likely to experience both sleepwalking and night terrors. Now, this study, Caleb, didn't look at in any way how sleep paralysis might be involved. But sleep paralysis is something that's always interested me, and I have often heard that people who experience it say that their parents experienced it just as well. You remember Justin, our friend? He told us that, he told me many times, actually, about his strange experiences with sleep paralysis, and I actually documented a few of those in Magic Mysticism of the Molecule. The most stark of them involved him waking to see what he said was a samurai in full armor, covered in blood, and he said that he had like a washboard on a chain around his neck, and that the samurai pointed at him and said, "The serotonin in your mind is gone. You are blank." And then he disappeared, and Justin said, "I woke up from the experience thinking, what in the world just happened?" And he told me that, indeed, his father had said that he had suffered from sleep paralysis just as well. But he said what was strange about that case was that he claimed to have been told by this samurai during his sleep paralysis episode something very specific about serotonin. And later he was actually diagnosed with what he said specialists believe was an imbalance in his body that affected the serotonin production in his brain, which is pretty interesting. Now, if that is indeed true, that would seem to be an interesting case where something that he either dreamed or experienced during a sleep paralysis episode actually preceded a medical diagnosis, and he was told this information during that sleep paralysis episode. And I've had other people tell interesting stories before just as well. You know, Caleb, we've got a friend named Sam, and I'm not disclosing people's last names here because without them here, I don't want to just tell these stories, but I do at least have permission to talk about these things, and I've written about them over the years from these individuals. But Sam, a friend of ours, Caleb, a mutual friend of yours, mine, and Matthew Oakley, Sam had a unique scar on his hand, and he said, "I want to tell you about the story about how I got this scar." And he had claimed that it had occurred during a sleep paralysis type experience where he said that he and his friends were attacked by this green-skinned man wielding a knife, and that he said as he awoke from the dream, he was unable to move and saw the green-skinned man in the room who came at him and slashed the knife, and he said that he developed a scar on his hand where the knife had come close to grazing the skin. Pretty interesting stuff. And it makes you wonder how much might be able to pour over from the field of dreams, so to speak, and into the waking reality. Caleb, I know you've had a lot of experiences over the years, though, that involve what you call lucid dreams. And there's one I'm thinking of specifically. You may have told it before on the show, but would you actually be willing to tell that story again? Because I know that it had to do with something you were dreaming that actually had some similarity to something that was happening at that time in real life.
I've had a couple of experiences like that, but I actually have another one that I've probably told less on the show that was a sleep paralysis kind of thing. I had a dream that there was like a nest of... I was in a hotel in Texas, and I had a dream that there was like a nest of birds in my bed, and when I got... like, I thought it was real, and I was obviously dreaming, so I popped up, and I remember like standing there in the hotel looking at my bed. And although I was awake, I was also asleep, and I could see the birds, like, trying to get out of my bed sheets, underneath the sheets, and then I just kind of, like, came out of it, and it went away. It was really, really weird.
That is bizarre. Well, you know, I hear a lot of people, and we've talked a good bit about dreams. I've had people actually send along dreams that they have had that seem to bear anomalous characteristics. You could do an entire, and actually, this would be very interesting to do because, you know, I got my copy in the mail of, and I've read these books over the years. I've had scans been made for me. I've of course, you know, frequented the Science Frontiers website. I ordered a copy of that first really thick book of William R. Corliss's Scientific Anomalies, and they go into everything. I mean, you know, geology, even mathematics. I mean, anomalies in all branches of science. But it would be interesting to do a study on dreams that documents various anomalous occurrences that include everything from, you know, again, those who claim to have a dream where the manifestation of a physical effect or phenomena occurs apart from that dream, like Sam's story of the alleged scar. Of course, I think probably a modern psychologist would explain that as being, you know, hindsight bias. Well, he had the scar. He may not have remembered where he got it. It could have been from a cat claw or from, you know, a bike accident or something. And he misremembered the dream sequence as being the cause behind the scar without the actual scar being formed as a result of the dream. And this would be the hindsight bias or something essentially appropriately linked to it. But, you know, if there were a serious examination of what people claim to have happened with them in dreams that looked at those cases, precognitive cases where people dream something that occurs before it actually happens in the real world, you know, other kinds of premonitions, symbols in dreams and things like that, you know, a truly scientific study, or at very least a collection of information that may also have already been included in scientific literature that looks at that kind of thing. You talk about one hell of an interesting study. Dreams really do fascinate me. And on the Graylian X podcast a while back, we spent a good bit of time talking about that. Those of you who aren't subscribers, by the way, this past week we actually presented some new information on Graylian X about an old mystery we've talked about a good bit on this show. That involves the airships that were being reported in the United States around the late 1890s. A very interesting lead in this. And I'll give you a little hint, by the way. As a matter of fact, over at mysteriousuniverse.org, I've got an article that would have been published just in the last few days that talks about this. A very interesting case to be made for the fact that not only were there possibly airships that were being built, but a lot of historic resources have left out some known cases dating back to 1863 where airships were indeed being built. And maybe there's a possibility that there were some that were being built that were left entirely out of most historical references. But I digress. Now, looking ahead a little bit at what else has been going on in the news, we talk about sleep paralysis and we talk about nightmares. Well, you know, what was happening down there in Texas this weekend was pretty scary. That's right. A day after police killed two gunmen who tried to ambush a Garland, Texas event, and this was genius to me, it featured controversial cartoons of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Details have begun to emerge about those two shooters. First of all, that sounds very provocative to me, and probably in truth wasn't a very good idea, but that's beside the point, I suppose. One suspect identified as Elton Simpson by a federal law enforcement source has apparently linked himself to ISIS in a tweet that was posted just before the attack. He also was no stranger to federal investigators. In 2011, this individual had been convicted of making a false statement involving international and domestic terrorism. The other suspect, identified as Nadir Sufi by two federal law enforcement officials, was Simpson's roommate in a Phoenix apartment, which, of course, you've probably been hearing all over the news today, was being investigated. He wasn't well known to federal law enforcement and was not on the FBI's radar, one of the officials said. Investigators were combing through evidence retrieved from the shooter's Arizona home to help piece together a timeline of how their plot came together. Simpson and Sufi never made it inside the Curtis Colwell Center in Garland, where, in addition to the cartoon contest, a right-wing Dutch politician who's on Al-Qaeda hit list was speaking Sunday evening. You know, so as a form of political speech, of course, they were engaging in a cartoon drawing contest that featured the Prophet Muhammad. Again, I have mixed feelings about this, because while that was obviously provocative and intended to be, it also shows that this is a circumstance that not just in France with Charlie Hebdo and other places, but here on American soil, it can be a serious danger just as well. And Caleb, speaking of precognitive dreams and discussions, were we not just talking about that the other day?
Indeed.
We were talking about the fact that you had been talking about your cartoons, the Clerk Chronicles, and your art that you do. And, of course, we can talk about your job, too, right?
I think it's safe to say it today. The website for the stuff I've been working on is going live. So
as of today, the website?
As of today.
Okay, we'll go ahead and just tell people a little bit about the website, who you're working for, and what you're doing.
I have been fortunate enough to do some artwork stuff for a company called To The Stars, and they are a new upcoming company. The mastermind behind it is the guitar player for the band Blink-182, Tom DeLonge, and it's all kind of paranormal-based stuff, so yeah, just kind of drawing some different things for that, but the website is going to be tothestars.media, and that should be going up live just a little bit later on today.
See, this is why people want to pay money, Caleb, to hang out with me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because remember, this is an interesting backstory to all this. So we do the first Paradigm Symposium. We had talked with him before, but our friends Jason and Maureen from Open Minds came out, hung out with us at the event. Then subsequently, in February, we went to the International UFO Congress, hung out with them again. I spoke there, and you came along and helped out as well. And, of course, after that, you and Jason started working together. You met one of the lead illustrators of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And through that ongoing relationship, Jason and Maureen, of course, eventually also finally had that breakthrough opportunity to interview Tom DeLonge. And I should point out, for those who don't know this already, we've talked about it on the show, Tom DeLonge, I have to say, is quite, maybe remarkably well-versed in UFO research and literature. And he's not just one of these guys who he's got a little interest in it. I mean, Tom DeLonge, I've heard him speak incredibly, including during the Open Minds interview, incredibly intelligently about not just the idea of alien life and aliens, but the UFO phenomena and all the different possible explanations for it. And who'd have thunk, Caleb, that within 2 years you'd be working for the guy? See, folks, you hang out with me, it puts you in touch with the stars. To the stars, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, like, Tom really is really well-educated about the subject of ufology, and he really has read, like, so many books, but I think that people tend to give him I feel like a lot of company or a lot of media on the internet tends to kind of use him and his star power for clickbait by making him look like he's a whack. And they'll put up a headline saying something like Tom DeLonge thinks his phone is bugged and that he's being chased by aliens and blah blah blah. But when you actually like listen to the interview, that he's had some interesting experiences when he's been like outside Area 51, but not any of them are him saying I think aliens were actually after me or anything like that. But yeah, I mean, if you have a chance, check out the interview with him that Jason and Maureen from Open Minds did, and he's an incredibly educated person. He's really, really smart about this stuff.
I'd love to have him on this show at some point. He's an extremely busy guy, but at some point I would love to get him on this show because I'd like to just have a talk with him about that, and we could get into some of the nerd stuff too, because he's obviously a devoted nerd like we are. And by the way, Caleb, I should also say to you, sir, May the 4th be with you, sir.
Yeah.
Happy, that's right. Yeah. Happy Star Wars Day to you, Caleb. That's right. Here on this hallowed day known as May 4th, well, of course, we celebrate that most famous space western known as Star Wars. Now, USA Today reported today it's an official, unofficial holiday on Monday. If you speak Wookiee, pilot a TIE fighter, or dream of vacationing in Cloud City, May 4th is Star Wars Day. Now, fans of the franchise greet each other with May the 4th be with you all day in a nod to the classic movie line, May the Force be with you. The holiday was grassroots in origins thanks to the internet allowing fans to unite and connect with each other. Now, according to StarWars.com, the earliest reference to May 4th today actually comes from 1979 when author Alan Arnold was chronicling the making of the second film in the franchise. But in order of the storyline, it was actually film 5, as we all know. That was The Empire Strikes Back, and that's widely regarded by many still as the finest of all the Star Wars films. My personal favorite, in fact. Now, Arnold wrote on May 4th, 1979, Margaret Thatcher has won the election and become Britain's first woman prime minister. To celebrate their victory, her party took a half page of advertising space in the London Evening News. This message referring to the day of victory was, May the 4th be with you, Maggie. Congratulations. Further proof of the extent to which Star Wars has influenced us all. Caleb, how have you celebrated Star Wars Day?
Well, I kind of celebrate Star Wars Day every day because, as you may or may not know, I'm an incredibly huge nerd. But one way that I celebrated...
Hold on. You're not that large. You're a fairly thin guy, actually.
I'm small, but my my nerd knowledge is intense and useless. But one way to celebrate is to say happy birthday to our friend Maureen Ellsbury, who we were talking about. Today is her birthday. She is a Star Wars baby.
Star Wars baby indeed. Yeah, I wished Maureen a happy birthday earlier today, in fact. And you know, what's interesting is that there's actually a bit of an interesting tie-in here, Caleb. In addition to Star Wars, we could also tie in another famous sci-fi character with all this.
Oh, you have a lot to do.
That's, of course, the voice of Tom Baker, the fourth actor to play Doctor Who in the British sci-fi series Doctor Who. And our friend Jimmy Williams, Caleb, down in Greenville, posted the coolest image.
I saw that. That was awesome.
I had to repost that this morning. Star Wars on top, and it was the screenshot of the famous Wookiee Chewbacca and the current Harrison Ford. This is the screenshot from the latest Star Wars teaser trailer. Chewie, we're home. Looking as old and grizzled as ever. And then
Chewie's just still, like, looks like he's 20.
Yeah, and then below that, may the 4th be with you, and then below that is the image of Tom Baker as he's kind of falling backwards.
With jelly babies.
Yes, indeed.
Spewing everywhere.
Yeah, which you remember, actually, Tom falling backward like that, I suppose that was in the trailer for The Day of the Doctor that BBC aired last year in conjunction with the 50th anniversary. And if we remember correctly, I believe Tom Baker's doctor met his demise after a severe fall that occurred. And, of course, this instigates his regeneration. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about falling, severe scares, critical injuries and falls, and people who have survived them. As a matter of fact, here's a little hint. Someone in the studio tonight recently survived one of those kind of falls. We'll talk about that and more when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Did you like how I dropped that Hobbs?
Sometimes you got to drop the Hobbs.
That's right. You know, that's something that I wonder how many people are familiar with this, but I happen to know that if we should actually call his iPhone right now, because if you call Race Hobbs, you'll actually hear his voicemail. It's very professional. Hi, you reach Race Hobbs of KGRI Radio Network. And then at the very end, he says, Hobbs. And, you know, we post online about this all the time, and I've had people get, like, ill with me. They're like, why do you guys constantly say Hobbs? Race, are you over there?
Yes.
Of course he is.
Hobbs.
Yeah. Where exactly did Hobbs come from, by the way?
I don't know. It's something me and you came up with in one of our late night get-togethers, you know.
Yeah, Race and I, when I have a little bit of time on my hands, we're both so busy these days, but yeah, we like to catch up off the mic quite frequently. And, you know, considering that he is a producer and, I guess, an unofficial co-host of this show, we were talking earlier during our Monday meetup that we usually do for business purposes, and I just told him, I said, you know, Race is there all the time. We need him more on this program. And that will help offset those listener emails where people say, Micah, breathe and let your co-hosts speak from time to time.
Well, in the following that fashion, I want to say, Race, sometimes it's I have these weird thoughts in my head because we don't really see you that much. At least I don't see you that much, but I hear your voice on the radio like once a week. So sometimes I just forget that it's you over there, and I just feel like your voice is so powerful. You're just like Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors. It's like you're just a giant plant back there talking.
Yeah.
Well, building on what Cal B just said, I'll just say that it's a pleasure to hang out in the no lackey zone.
The no lackey zone. That's right. Yeah. Because that's what we don't need. We don't need lackeys around here.
No lackeys.
Oh, man. So in the last segment, I mentioned, you know, falls. And it was interesting because, you know, Tom Baker's fourth Doctor, I remember him lying there on the ground. This is the end, but the moment has been prepared for, you know, lying there at the end of Logopolis. And as I'm thinking about that, I have a story to tell, Caleb. This is a true story of certainly doesn't involve wisdom. But it involves my pastimes that occur outside of the Graelian bunker. Yes, despite that stereotype that I live in a cave and stay there, I do get out from time to time. And here in beautiful western North Carolina, I got to be honest with you. You look at these mountains, it's hard not to want to go outside and enjoy nature in all its splendor, which yesterday after a marathon riding session that lasted from about 10 a.m. to 5:45 or so, I decided to get out and go on a hike. Now, hike for me doesn't just mean go find a nice trail and follow it. I often will, on property where it is legal to do so, I will get off the beaten path, so to speak. And I've been known to engage in a little bit of, you know, free-handed rock climbing.
You like to crawl up in there.
I like to crawl up in there, yeah. And I've been known to do a little rock climbing and mountain climbing. I prefer to say mountain climbing because I think rock climbing, again, is properly done kind of like spelunking with gear, you know, often on a sheer, you know, face, whereas mountain climbing involves climbing a mountain, and often there are rocks, caves, grottos, and things along the way. Well, there's an area that I have frequented here in western North Carolina near Girton, and it's a little town which is outside of the general area where I live, and I'd gone up there to this location where I like to do mountain climbing and rock climbing, and others in the area do too, and there are ropes and things actually hooked up. There's one portion of this area where, just for exercise, to get up to the top, you know, it's a lot of fun climbing, but to get up to the top along this one area, you have to kind of crawl through this little grotto, and I decided brilliantly that I wanted to crawl along the outside of this stone face, which would lead me, I was only up about maybe 15-20 feet from the ground level on the forest below me. You know, again, I'm going to just stick with 15 feet, the lower figure. I hazard to guess really the exact distance. I didn't stick around to measure. I've been to this area many times, and for whatever reason yesterday, I decided to do a little bit of climbing on the exterior of this passage that I've visited and frequented. And I got to say, you know, I always try to maintain and observe safety. Safety is, that goes without saying. I don't even recommend that people ever do anything akin to rock climbing or mountain climbing without proper gear. And since I had intended to just be hiking, of course, that was my intention. I didn't have any gear or anything like that. And I mentioned there are ropes in this location, but that's really just, you know, ropes that people have included at this location where others go and they'll climb there. Well, as I'm attempting to investigate, I hadn't actually begun climbing. I was investigating whether there were enough grips that I could use to actually climb up the face of this rock around an area where you have to pass through a small cave. I decided rather than going into the mountain, I would try and travel up the side of it. As I'm investigating, I was merely testing a couple of foot grips. I lose my balance. And I initially had managed to grab a hold of a grip, but then my hand slipped. And at this moment, if you've ever been in this situation, you know the feeling. You feel yourself falling backward. First, I think it was my right shoulder that hit a tree. And at that point, I want you to count with me. 1,002. And then I hit the ground. Now, during that time, we're talking about at least 15 feet between me and the ground that my body fell. And I hit the ground, landing on my back. And lying there, what's not so scary is not lying there. The scary part was being in the air long enough to think, what's going to happen when I hit the ground? That was a new sensation for me, Caleb. Being in the air long enough to be able to think, this is going to suck!
I'm only going to say this to you once. Don't do that crap again, you doofus.
Yeah. I promise I won't. I learned my lesson yesterday, and that's why I decided I would tell this story, because I got to be honest, it's a dangerous game. I have been always, throughout my life, a bit of a daredevil. And yesterday could have really, really, really been bad.
I mean, the thing about it is if you are going to go into the woods, I'm not saying you specifically, I'm saying anybody, if you're going to go into the woods by yourself, if you're hiking, if you're going on a run, whatever, it's always a good idea to, at very least, just text message somebody, tell them, hey, this is where I'm going to be. Just want to give somebody a heads up. I mean, you know, my dad was telling me a couple of weeks ago that down there he has a hunt club. He likes to go deer hunting, and this guy and his kid were deer hunting, and the guy, they were using tree stands, and the guy called his dad, didn't hear anything from him, so he went up by where his dad was stationed, and he had not securely put himself in the tree stand hitch, and he had fallen out of the tree and broke his neck and died.
It can happen. It can really happen. You know, there's a little more to my story. Actually, I want to come back to it. But what you're saying there though ties in with this, because
I'm just saying, you know, if he had been by himself, nobody would have found him forever. I mean, maybe they would have been able to save him, but
yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, and again, you're right. It's important. First of all, usually I would say never hike alone, but a lot of people do. And that gets a little into the realm of these missing 411 cases. But when you have something happen like what I experienced yesterday, I want to say I'm okay. I'm in a little bit of pain.
People at home, you can't see Micah sitting here in his full body brace.
Yeah, I'm in a full cast. No. No, I'm very lucky. I would actually say, as I teased earlier, I think I've got a guardian angel in truth, because when I fell, again, falling out of the tree is probably what saved my life, because at one point my back is extremely scratched up, but hitting the tree probably broke my fall enough that when I thudded against the ground, my lower back was a little hurt, and at that moment, imagine this, you hit the ground, you're lying there, you're thinking, okay, my neck could be broken, my back could be broken, and I'm able to stand up, and I'm a little sore, but I'm thinking, okay, everything feels okay, but you can sometimes further injure yourself if you're not careful as you're getting up. So I get up very carefully. I'm allowing, you know, branches and trees around in my immediate vicinity to support my weight at first. And when I'm very confident that I'm able to walk without injuring myself, then I head on down the trail. I wasn't even dizzy. And I'm just like, whoa, what happened? Well, through, you know, along the car ride home, I was only a short distance from where I'd parked my vehicle. And I get back in my car. Walking wasn't so uncomfortable. It was trying to sit after that. It was a little uncomfortable. I got home. You should have seen me. I looked like I'd been struck by lightning. I mean, my hair was all messed up. It was covered in lichen. I looked like Swamp Thing.
Even more than usual.
Even more than usual, yeah. I showered off. I'm glad he's laughing about this. You sick person, sick!
I'm able to laugh at it because you're not dead. And in hindsight, providing that you don't have any internal bleeding or anything, which you may want to go get checked out, it is pretty funny.
Well, you know, again, I got home and I started noticing I felt remarkably good considering what had just happened. So I actually drove to the store and, you know, purchased what I would have for dinner and then also some painkillers. Only ended up taking one of them and two mineral baths, one last night, one today. And my inordinarily active mutant healing factor seems to have all but healed me. I as good as a person can feel after falling 15 feet off of a rock face and landing on his back, I feel pretty good. I think that the flesh wounds on my back look a lot worse. They don't actually even hurt. I look, at least, you know, below my collar, worse than I actually feel. But yeah.
Well, with your mutant healing factor, be glad that you walked out of there Wolverine and not rolled out of there Professor X.
I've said the exact same thing. I was talking to my friend Venus about that, and I said the exact same thing. And you know, I'm a blessed individual, but it made me think about things. And the reason I chose to even talk about this on the podcast, I'm sure a lot of people are sitting at home going, you idiot. I'm sure there'll probably be some people saying, no, he made that up. That totally didn't happen. I can assure you.
No, I've seen him. He's all scratched up and weirder looking.
Yeah, I mean, definitely there was some, But the thing is that, you know how I am. An experience like this begins to affect me in the way that it makes me think about these disappearances that occur. And I can guarantee there are probably people who get out there in the forest. They never intend to do anything dangerous or put themselves in a dangerous position, but it happens. And when they fall into a position, like if they fall into a small ravine or something like that, just a few days, exposure, a cold rain on a rather cool night, hypothermia, there are any number of factors that could even an experienced individual, we're talking, that even an experienced hiker could succumb to. And so I recommend, please, people, you know, you practice, you know, safe outdoor activities. If you're going to go hiking, preferably do it with a friend. Carry a smartphone or a cell phone or something with you. And at least if you are going to go off by yourself, please let somebody know where you're going before you go. I think those things are very important. Now, that said, we're going to breeze through this break and just stick with this because I wanted to look at some of these cases. We've got so much news to get to.
Well, before we get to that, I just want to say I'm glad that you're okay.
And me too.
Do you feel more in like a more environmentalist sort of since a tree kind of saved your life?
Yeah, I want to protect trees more now that one saved my life. I mean, that was the closest I think I've ever come to death, in truth.
That
and a car accident. And that's the strange thing, too, as I was telling you before the show, in the car accident a few years ago, I was told in the emergency room I would need stitches. I was told by the wonderful ladies in the operating room, as they were cutting my clothing off of me, that I was going to need stitches. I kept telling them, I was like, trust me, you don't know me, I'll be fine. And when the surgeon or the doctor came in there and looked at it, he says, yeah, you could probably need stitches, but let me go look at your x-rays. And he came back into the room, he said, you know, call me crazy, but go home and put some Neosporin on that. I think you're going to be okay.
And you're like, thanks, bub.
You know, yeah, exactly. And then my claws popped out, you know. It's almost incredible, you know, and I'm not really claiming to have a mutant healing factor. I think, as Race and I were talking about earlier today, it kind of goes to show the resilience of the human body in general. And I'm an athletic person. I eat right. I take good care of myself. And so I'm sure a lot of that affected this just as well. But this is serious stuff. All joking aside for a moment, you know, seriously, please take care of yourselves out there in the woods. This was a wake-up call for me, and I've been an avid outdoorsman my entire life. Never had anything like this ever happen. And sometimes you also have to recognize what you may have once been capable of versus what you're able to do today. You know, I might be athletic, but I'm also at the ripe old age of, how old am I now, 32?
You don't look a day over 25.
Yeah, well, 32 in Earth years, you know. I'm some 2,000 years in Time Lord years. But now, that said, there have been some instances throughout history that I wanted to look at here where people have fallen and managed to survive. Josh Hansen in 2007, he was attending a dart-throwing convention in Minneapolis, and he drunkenly fell through a double-pane window and dropped 160 feet. He sustained a broken leg, two collapsed lungs, and a few bruises, but he survived. We've also got Steve Fawcett. Steve Fawcett fell from his hot air balloon at 2,200 feet, but he survived a plunge into shark-infested waters. That's even better. So you fall out of a balloon into shark-infested waters, survived. Yeah, he was very, very lucky. Let's see here. We've also got Roger Woodward on vacation at Niagara Falls with his family. After a boating accident, Roger fell into the water and was swept over the falls wearing only a life jacket. He's the youngest person to go over the falls, unprotected, but he's also survived. Danny Yamashiro, on December 22nd, 1985, he and his girlfriend climbed Nuanu Pali Mountain in Hawaii. During the hike, Danny attempted to help his stranded girlfriend and fell headfirst 300 feet down the mountain. He fell a second time after that, after which he fell another 100 feet and still survived. Cliff Judkins survived a 15,000-foot drop while flying an F-8 fighter. A mid-air refueling accident forced him to jump from his aircraft. His parachute failed to deploy, and then he sustained a broken back, ankles, pelvis, and a collapsed lung. He also suffered kidney and intestine failure. Frain Salak was a Croatian music teacher. He escaped death seven times, must have been part cat, and he also won the lottery. Now, one year, he was sucked out of a malfunctioning plane door and landed in a haystack. Boy, talk about luck.
The gods really have it out for these people.
Well, no, apparently not Frayne, or me for that matter, but James Boole, while skydiving, James survived a fall of 6,000 feet without a parachute. Now, I know this guy's story. This guy, okay, well, if it's the same one I'm thinking of, this fella, it says, suffered a broken back and multiple broken ribs. It's estimated that when he hit the ground, he was going 60 miles per hour. I don't guess he's the one I know, because there was another fellow I saw who had a camera attached to his headgear. He was skydiving, his parachute failed to deploy, and the entire thing, of course, was being filmed, keep in mind. And as he is coming along. He says, I'm beginning to see the tops of the trees coming nearer and nearer. And he said, I knew I was just going to hit the ground and go splat. And so I just kind of tucked in my shoulder a little to hope, you know, maybe that would help a little bit, maybe, you know, duck and roll. And he said, when he hit the ground, that he hit the ground and he got that sensation in his nose like if you'd been hit real hard. And otherwise was okay. And he jumps up, and you can see this on video. He starts jumping up and down, screaming expletives. He can't believe he just fell out of a plane, hit the ground, and survived, and wasn't even damaged. Wasn't even hurt.
I would imagine that the audio from that just sounded like the scene in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, where they're just falling down the endless pit, just screaming, ah, forever.
Yeah. Now here's another one. Larice Butler was on a routine skydiving jump when her parachute failed as well. She could only pray to God on her way down, asking him to save her. After falling 3,000 feet, she slammed into the ground. She only broke her leg and suffered a mild concussion, and she believes that after praying that indeed God had saved her. But when we talk with Alex Sakiris in Hour 2, that's one thing I want to talk with him, which he addresses in his book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. This, of course, a fantastic book by Anomalous Books. Rupert Sheldrake wrote the foreword for this book, and he addresses atheism in the book. I want to talk about that a little bit just as well, but a couple more here. Alan McGee was a B-17 bomber pilot in World War II. He fell 2,200 feet from his plane and crashed through the glass roof of the St. Nazarene Railroad Station. He had 28 shrapnel wounds and several broken bones, but he also survived. Hans Lang, a base jumper, leapt from Bjorkentind Mountain during his wingsuit, or using his wingsuit, but the jump went horribly wrong. He got too close to the mountain wall, going at least 100 miles per hour, hit the mountain multiple times, and painfully ricocheted down, kind of like I did when I hit that tree. He only broke his leg. And the list goes on. I mean, there are just untold numbers of people who have been fortunate enough not to be seriously injured from a fall like that. And I think a little of it does have to do with, you know, knowing how to turn your body as you're falling. But then again, you know, I wonder which would have been better, falling on my back or landing on my leg and potentially breaking it. So I don't like to think of it about it that much. I include all of this more as a public service announcement for people than anything. You know, in the last few minutes of this hour, maybe we'll move on to some other things. Caleb, first of all, I wanted to ask you, have you seen this really weird-looking video that involves what people are calling an alien worm? I mean, it's going viral on Facebook right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've seen Dick Cheney interviews before. It was... Oh, I'm sorry. The other one.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like a worm. Well, you know, again, I saw this thing. What you see in the video, I'm sure a lot of you out there know what I'm talking about. This worm is like crawling around in this guy's hand. This pincer-like protrusion comes out of what appears to be its face, or maybe its rear end. And then all of a sudden you see this, like, what looks kind of like a white, almost like the structure of veins or like coral or like vines or something, just crawls out all over this guy's hand. And at first I saw this and I'm thinking, okay, that's got to be CG. You know, this isn't legitimate. Well, I looked into it a little more, and actually IFLS carried this story as well. They say they actually think that this is a variety of worm, okay, a nematine, is recognized. I'm serious.
No, these are the seeds of the Nephilim.
Oh, by the way, did you see the photograph of Megan Fox carrying Scotty Roberts' Rise and Fall of the Nephilim? Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, talk about great Photoshop job. No, I'm kidding. No, that was legit.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's like Scotty gets on the internet and just like scoops up all the pictures he can and repopulates them.
Well, you know, again, I should just really briefly say, and then we'll come back to this mystery alien worm with this horrific looking, you know, vein-like proboscis, because that's what this actually is, and we'll talk about it in a moment. But you know, a lot of interviewers, and I've always come to her defense, a lot of people have given Megan Fox guff about her interest in the unexplained Bigfoot and things like that. And they always ask, well, what books do you read? Well, now you know. She reads Scotty Roberts' Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And there's a picture online that she apparently posted. I don't know if she actually posted the photo, but it appeared online.
No, it was
online.
A paparazzi. It was not her.
But it shows her carrying the book along as she's walking. So anyway, now coming back to this IFLS article, the one fairly reputable science news site, the name of which I cannot say on this program, so use your imagination, but you know what I'm talking about. They believe that this is what's called the Gorgonor hincus. That's all one word. Gorgonor hincus, a variety in the species of the nematine. They believe that this is a proboscis, which is kind of like, essentially, I guess you could liken it to like an elephant's trunk or something like that, an extended what would you call it again?
It's like a trunk, traditionally.
Well, the term I'm trying to use is, I don't want to say probe, but I guess an extended appendage that assists with feeding.
It's like a big, weird, long tongue, I guess.
Yeah, that's, I guess, how you could kind of roughly...
But if you haven't seen the video, it doesn't look like a tongue. I mean, it honestly looks like a vein system.
Yes, exactly. Now, apparently, what they describe here in this IFLS article, they quote J.F.G. Wheeler's study, which was the discovery of the Nemertine Gorgonohyrincus, and it's bearing, I'm probably horribly butchering that name, but this is the taxonomical name of this particular worm species. And it's bearing on evolutionary theory. And he writes, the proboscis of the Nemertines usually consists of an introverted tube in a proboscis sheath, and it is inverted like a finger of a glove that has been pulled outside in. Now, this new Nemertine that they're apparently showing in the video has also a proboscis which is retractile within a proboscis sheath. That also is branched. The branching is of the dichotomous type. During eversion, which takes place almost explosively, the short main trunk first appears and then divides, and the finer filter branches appear, and since each one of these is the result of an evangination, the effect is almost indescribable. It is as if a large number of live, wriggling, minute worms had been shot out of this thing's mouth. So the strange white thing that seems to erupt from the worm is actually the tubular sucking organ that some worms use to feed. It's essentially smelling this guy's hand to see if it's something that can be eaten. That's really nice.
But I understand why people were think it is alien, because it is by far the most alien-looking video footage I've ever seen. I've seen all kinds of crazy animals. We were looking at earlier today, what's the kind of fish, that giant fish that came up on the shore?
Let's say, which one we're talking about?
Not a sunfish.
No, not the lungfish. It's the...
The lumpfish.
Yeah. And it's not a glass eel either. I have to look at it, actually.
Which is basically a giant blob. It looks like Sloth from Goonies with one fin.
Yeah.
Giant, just swimming down. I mean, like, those things are pretty incredible looking, but this thing is genuinely alien, like something out of the movies. Looking so weird.
Reptile in the chat room says, I always use a proboscis sheath.
Ah, good man.
Yes, indeed. Red Pill Junkie says, thanks, my young Padawan. We all appreciate that. Chris Brown suggested an oarfish, but I think this actually, what you saw, was not an oarfish either.
I can pull it up.
You know, speaking of things that look alien, though, Caleb, before we go to break here, I also want to bring up this this interesting video that you had linked, which actually doesn't have to do with biology. Okay? This is interesting to me, because rather than being something biological that resembles alien technology, this quadcopter that you linked the video to, this thing is absolutely incredible. We've got it linked today at Graylian Report Daily News. If you're listening to the podcast rather than the live show, check out May 4th, 2015. Just remember, May the 4th be with you. And just look this up, because we've got this thing. Take a look if you can keep up at this super fast quadcopter drone. That's the title of the link. This is absolutely incredible. This thing, I love how you see the little guy buzz, and then whee, and it just shoots straight up in the sky.
Well, see, when I saw this video, I immediately was like, this thing is moving a lot like UFO reports from a long time ago. And if you are with the theory that that UFOs are future tech or highly more advanced tech than we have, think about this, Micah. So on the majority of the drones that come out, they're usually quadcopters, and they can pretty much fly up, down, diagonal, any way that you can think of. So if you look at like a theoretical turbine in, like, say, Avengers, how they have those big floating, basically they're like, you know, Navy ships, but they are able to fly because they've got giant turbines like drones, except they're more protected, they're heavier, obviously, they're made of more sturdy materials. It would seem possible that some of these UFOs, as we see them, if they are technology that is not from here on Earth, and maybe if they are from here on Earth, maybe they are figuring out some way to basically encapsulate that kind of propulsion just on a larger scale than what we're seeing with these drones.
Maybe so. Who knows? I mean, it's interesting. And then the other way that we could interpret this just as well is, I guess we could suppose that maybe some of these extremely high strange reports from yesteryear involve technologies that are becoming not only commonplace, but accessible to everybody with drone technologies today. It's not impossible. And when you see that video, you may think the same thing. Corey Kowal recently said to me, Caleb, you know, there goes being able to say it behaved unlike any known man-made craft. We'll be back in a moment with Alex Securus here on the Grayling Report.
Is the Grayling Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia, and boy, let me tell you, I know how high they are. I'm Micah Hanks, along with Caleb Hanks, my co-host, my brother, and also one of our fine producers here at Grayling Report Master Studios. Glad to be with you as always, keeping you company from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time here on the one and only Global Radio Alliance, KGRARadio.com. You can learn more about what they do at the aforementioned website. And, of course, if you'd like to visit mine, it's www.grayling.com, where we feature news every day of the week. And, of course, podcasts like this one that you can download and enjoy for free. If you'd like to become a member, however, we do offer a little more for those who want it. Grayling X is what we call our subscriber area. Head on over to graylingreport.com/X, and you could sign up. It's only $7 a month, and as I've said often in the past, that is less than most fast food meals these days that I'm going to tell you, for your health, you probably shouldn't be eating anyway. Oh, boy. But something that you will want to consume, and that you'll want to roll around in your mind a little, is the conversation that we are about to have with a gentleman who I already have a profound respect for. I'm holding in my hands his latest book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. The author is Alex Securus, and of course, this is associated with his very well-known website, Skeptico.com. Now, if you don't follow Skeptico.com, the name actually, in a lot of ways, may be misleading. And I'm going to let Alex tell us a little bit about that. But I'm going to tell you right now, I think one thing that he and I have in common is the modern approach to skepticism, or rather our our trouble with it. And that is something that he addresses eloquently in this new book. Alex, welcome to the program.
Micah, it's really, really great to be here. I've been excited to get in this conversation with you. And I just have to add, I am totally down with what you just said. I think we share a kinship in that we're two people who are trying to reclaim that word skeptic and turn it back to what it really means. I think you do an awesome job of that. And we ought to have a good time talking about it.
We certainly will, my friend. We certainly will, because what you just said, reclaiming the term skeptic. Now, you realize, coming on this program and talking about this, there will be probably those in the modern skeptic community who will take issue or maybe even offense with it. They'll write articles about it. You know, they'll talk about it on their podcasts. But I'm sure you're okay with that by now.
Yeah, you have to be. I mean, number one, I like engaging in the dialogue. I really do. And I find that most skeptical people really are pretty thoughtful people. I mean, they've given this stuff consideration, which is the first step, right? And one thing I like about your show is you take a very intelligent approach at getting at these. You know, you're always digging towards the science, digging towards the known in order to kind of propel us into the unknown. And I have to say, for the most part, I have to give skeptics credit that they at least come at it that way. I mean, at least they're grabbing some kind of knowledge. They're not totally just disinterested, which is unfortunately what it seems like most people are.
Oh, absolutely. You're entirely right. You know, I mean, as a matter of fact, just an example, you know, this gentleman who we've talked about on the program before, his name is Jason Colavito. He's written numerous articles that I don't think, as far as what he writes about me, are necessarily fair or even always accurate, but I commend him in terms of his research and what he's doing, his interest in the subject, and most of the time, I think his capabilities as a researcher, I admire him a lot, and I've even said that before. Now, he may not feel the same about me, but I just want to put that out there. And I see throughout your book that you engage in very similar respectful dialogue with skeptical researchers, Benjamin Radford being one of them. And you and he actually, throughout your book, it's evidence that you guys have actually worked together on a lot of things. And it just goes to show that people don't necessarily have to agree to influence one another positively and actually help one another grow and come to new understandings.
Up to a point. I don't think Ben doesn't take my calls anymore. So, you know, that's not entirely true, because we have had some follow-on discussions after the investigation that you are referring to that we did together. And we spent a lot of time together doing this investigation. But sometimes, Mike, and maybe you've experienced this, you do get kind of to a breaking point where, you know, I just do feel that Ben completely misrepresented, there's no other way to say it, misrepresented the facts in this case in a way different than he would express them to me. You know, so when a guy's saying one thing to you and then he's going out there publicly and saying something completely different, well, you know, I had to call him on that, and I did, and I still to this day. And every time I go on a show, I say, hey, if Ben ever wants to challenge what I'm saying, ever wants to debate me, he's welcome to come on Skeptical. I'm happy to meet him on a neutral forum. But, you know, that's another thing I've found that maybe on the darker side of the skepticism thing is that, you know, when people stop engaging, to me, that's always a telltale sign. When you get someone and they have an opinion and they're out there and you say, great, come on, let's hash it out, and they duck and they dodge and they don't want to do it, there's usually a good reason for that, and that's because they don't really have the goods and they're afraid of being exposed.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, I want to ask you about the title of your website, because obviously, and again, I consider myself a skeptical person. I think that there are some who I've met, P.Z. Myers, who I've talked with a bit in the past. He probably wouldn't consider me at very least skeptical enough, if at all a skeptic. He'd probably say the same about you. But then again, his issues with the modern skeptic movement, Alex, also led him to apparently leave it. I think he really kind of finds negative skepticism rather distasteful, and he says it does nothing to advance science further. So what led you to actually brand your site with the name Skeptico.com? You've been around for a while now.
I have. And, you know, it's funny, because right before we were talking, I was pulling up some information on that, because well-known skeptic Michael Shermer. Have you ever had Michael on your? Have you ever talked to Michael?
But he's another skeptic I really actually appreciate and admire in a lot of ways. I'll say that.
I've interviewed him a couple times, and I just interviewed him again a few weeks ago. And I like engaging with him. He's very skilled at what he does, if you will.
Sure.
But we kind of got into it on a couple of points. But I pulled up this quote, because skeptic means something different to you and me than it means to other people. And if you really go back and capture the essence of the original meaning of these ancient Greek philosophers, it comes from this term skeptikos. And that's spelled K-O-S, and that's how I spell my website. Skeptico is skeptikos, dropping off the S. But I dug up this quote by Shermer, and Shermer says, anyone can find this, he says, hey, the word skeptic, in fact, comes from the Greek skeptikos, meaning thoughtful, not the modern misconceptions. And he says, isn't this a glorious meaning, because it means that they were watchmen who guard against bad ideas, consumer advocates for good thinking. This is Michael Shermer. Now, this is my problem with the skeptical movement. If you really go and look up who these Greek philosophers were and what they really meant by skeptikos, it means something completely different than what Shermer said. These were folks who were against every statement whose contradiction could be advanced with equal justification. So what they said is, you know what? It's really hard to decide on anything. So we're going to withhold the agreeing to the consenting status quo opinion that everyone's driving us for, and we're going to sit back and continue to question, continue to probe, continue to not form a firm conclusion. That's what skepticos really means. Not watchmen to guard against bad ideas, which is code speak for defend the status quo at all cost. So to me, that's my problem with the modern skeptical movement, is even in the definition, even by the Pope there, Michael Shermer, they can't really get it right in terms of what they do. And what I really see, a big part of what they do is really defending the status quo. So it, you know, it doesn't matter what the issue is. They seem to always be saying, no, no, what the mainstream believes, that's what you should believe. And I think that's why folks are probably a little bit skeptical of your skepticism. I listen to your show and I find you to be extremely skeptical in a good way. You usually provide a lot of good supporting reasons for why you're skeptical of something. But when you go against the status quo, I think you're immediately going to be thrown out of the skeptical club. And that's why I think some folks probably do throw you out of that club.
Yes, most certainly. And, you know, for me personally, Alex, you know, I feel that there is, I would say, maybe even a majority of information that we could quote-unquote call status quo that is obviously good information. It's well-sourced. It's documented. It's repeatable. The problem is that I think that where we encourage a lot of hubris, I guess, is where we see, I don't know if I should say we encourage it, but I nonetheless find that it erupts around these areas where there are questions, okay? In other words, what may be phenomena that one day science will explain, but which we do not fully understand yet. And I see a lot of people who will pander what I think, frankly, are silly ideas, and that are, yes, very pseudoscientific. But when we have a potential unknown, like, for instance, one that you address throughout your book, what happens after we die? I don't think that the verdict is in as far as what actually happens, whether what people call a near-death experience is or is not something more than merely how your brain reacts to, you know, changes in oxygen levels and things in the blood at the time of apparent death. There was this study, and I told you actually I wanted to mention this, which just very briefly we can kind of go over. The Daily Mail carried the article titled, "Are Ghosts in the Mind Scientists Recreate Strange Phenomenon in the Lab?" And they talk about the fact that these eerie perceived presences and the sense that someone's in the room with you can be reproduced in the lab. And the article goes on to say there, now science has proven what causes ghostly experiences. And I'm thinking, but does that account for people who claim that they have seen a full-bodied apparition? Does that account for people who claim that they have had interactions, including audible interactions or speech, that that are included in these quote-unquote ghostly experiences? I don't know that essentially trying to define very loosely some sort of a phenomena that can be induced in a laboratory environment that has qualities that are similar to what some describe in quote-unquote ghost experiences or encounters, that one small portion explains the entire purported phenomena, which is truthfully something that's been with us since time immemorial. I mean, do you take the same issue with that I would?
Yeah, I read that when you sent it over to me, and I was both chuckling and shaking my fist at the same time. It's a rehash by this guy, Dr. Olaf Blank, who has done the exact same number on out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. It's really kind of hilarious because the headline, the way it's been spun in the science media, is exactly the same for those other two phenomena. That, hey, here is a guy who's recreated this experience, and therefore it explains the experience. Two huge problems with that. One is, as you alluded to, when you really dig into it, for people who have had those encounters, when they compare it to what he's recreated in the lab, they go, well, you know, some aspects of it, but no, it's really nothing like it. You know, there's a sense of a presence, but I didn't have this, 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 this. So when Blank, I'm not sure exactly how they pronounce his name, when he did it with near-death experience, it was the same thing. People were like, well, there's some of these elements that are the same, but the totality of the experience is nothing like what I experienced. So that's one problem with it. Then the other problem with it is the way that the science media portrays it. You know, they spin it with this headline that just bowls you over with, you know, fantastic new discovery, when it's not. And I guess the third thing that I think is significant about it is that it just it's a little bit too pat of an answer that for a really much bigger problem. And it gets at the question of, you know, again, what should be our starting point for trying to understand all of these phenomena? And I guess that would tie me back to the first part of what you were saying there, Micah, which is, you know, what happens after we die? And if I could, I'd break that down two ways. One, look at it from a historical cross-cultural perspective and realize that we are the only culture in history, at the only time in history, that has ever presupposed that nothing happens after you die. I mean, there's no other culture that thinks that. So you go over to Africa, they don't think that. You go to the Chinese, the ancient Chinese, they don't think that. You go to the Europeans 500 years ago, they didn't think that. You go out to the jungles of Indonesia where no one's ever touched, seen a human being from civilization. They don't believe that. Yet we're arrogant enough to think we've somehow discovered that. So number two, I'd say on that, for people just to consider, is what are you being sold as an alternative to that? You know, because it's never questioned. You're always just kind of presented with this, oh my God, you believe in life after death? That's not scientific. Oh, okay. What is your scientific, what is the scientific status quo definition of your consciousness, which is what we're talking about, right? We're saying consciousness, the you inside of you, that little voice inside your head, the near-death experience science people are saying, hey, that seems to survive after your brain dies. And then the materialist science, mainstream scientists are saying, no, that can't be. And the reason they're saying, no, that can't be, is because they say that you, everything about you, that little voice inside your head, is 100% a product of your brain. Now, that sounds reasonable enough. You're like, okay, I guess that's not, yeah, I do know if I get a brain injury, you know, these different things happen to that voice inside my head, to my consciousness. So I'm willing to buy that for a certain extent. But what folks don't realize is that if you really buy into that, then you're buying into the notion that you are no more than a biological robot. You are a stimulus response machine, you know, input, output. You don't really love. You don't really have any connection. You don't really have any feelings. Those are all illusions because you are essentially the stimulus and response biological robot. Now, that comes part and parcel with mind equal brain. You can't get over it. And if you try and explain that to people, they look at you with this look and say, no, they don't really believe that. No one really believes that I don't really love, that I don't really make connection. And yet, if you really tear it apart, that's what science is telling us when they insist that you are your brain, that your mind equals your brain.
It's interesting. You know, when I was in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 2 years ago, I was standing near enough to a conversation that was taking place between one of the conference attendees at the event that I was actually participating in, the Paradigm Symposium, and P.Z. Myers was there. And I spoke with P.Z. numerous times over the course of the weekend, and I've got to be honest, we tried to be... we tried to afford him as many amenities, you know, get him a bottle of water if he needed one. I find PZ to be a highly intelligent person. I enjoyed his presentation, but he was just not friendly. Yeah, no matter how hard I tried, I just found he just did not want to be friendly to me. I think because he presupposed what, even though I introduced myself as right. a skeptic to him, he presupposed that, you know, you're at this event, you couldn't possibly be of like mind to me. In fact, if anything, he acted as though you were just less than. But then again, he's known for being that way, and that's okay. That's just his personality, I suppose. But the interesting thing I heard him say overhearing this conversation is someone asked him, they say, you know, why don't you at least afford these things possibility. Why do you take the stance that you do? And he said, look, I'm here to disprove BS. I believe in certain things. I believe in love, he said. And I'm thinking, but you're an evolutionary biologist. Shouldn't an evolutionary biologist look at love as being merely a maybe a hormonal exchange? Some might just say it's also some sort of an intuitive way that we relate to similar organisms in a protective way that is conducive to the betterment and, of course, the continuation of our species. Love, mm-hmm. I suppose, in terms of that kind of evolutionary science, isn't really, really an altruistic, caring, I'm going to do even if it is not in my best interest because I want to give. No, love is something that is evolutionary, right? And here at PZ, I'm not saying he was contradicting himself. I found it interesting, though, that he would say, I believe in love. And I'm thinking that should be the last thing that an evolutionary biologist should believe in, huh?
Hey, that's funny that you run into those contradictions, though, don't you? You know, I had a chance to talk to, right after I talked to Shermer, I talked to Lawrence Krauss. You know him, the theoretical.
Absolutely. So, own some of his books.
You know, famous for this meaningless universe idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we live in a meaningless universe. So what I've taken to doing, Mike, in my interviews with several skeptics and atheists on the show, is to say, well, then you believe your life is meaningless. And they go, no, they just react, you know, really adamantly. No, no, I'm not saying that. There's great meaning in my life. And I find, you know, my camaraderie with that. I said, but how can there be meaning in your life if your life is in the universe and the universe is meaningless? Now, from a philosophical standpoint, that makes no sense whatsoever. It's just ironclad. You can't have that. If there's no meaning anywhere, then there can't be meaning in your life, except a false meaning, the illusion of meaning that you can create. But they're insistent, you know, when you really kind of drill them down. No, 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 you know. So I think that this is one of these things where we're kind of accustomed to living with these contradictions and these absurdities, and we somehow resolve them in our mind. But you're right. When you really push these guys, it's kind of amazing how they kind of fall down on philosophy 101. I mean, how can you claim to have a meaningless life in a meaningful life in a meaningless universe? Doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess unless we look at things in terms of, well, what is meaningful to humans? And really, I guess we have to say that to an extent. I like to think a little bit more broad-minded in my approach than that. But I think that, then again, this coming from the guy who some skeptics have referred to as a hillbilly with a website, which is funny to me because I see that there is the ad hominem attack that also comes about in relation to, well, if a person isn't skeptical enough, we can't merely refute their claims and do so in a friendly way. We have to be angry. We have to be bitter. We have to be, you know, in fact, at times very vile in our attacks against them, which is why in your book I was very happy to see that you carry yourself, Alex, like such a gentleman. You and Ben Radford, you and many others that you've had discourses with and sometimes disagreements, it's done in a very polite, gentlemanly way. Many I see in the skeptical community, and I have to say Mr. Myers is very guilty of this, they take and not only a dissuasive attitude and a derogatory attitude toward their opponents, but they do so in such a way that I think if instead they were doing so in an educative way, they would reach more people with their stance. Right or wrong, you're not going to you're not going to include people in the argument and make them feel good by arguing and being bitter and attacking them, and by being derogatory toward those individuals and launching attacks. It's very interesting. So I do think that there is a bit more of a cult persona that we see in this modern skeptical movement. And it's interesting how many peaceful interactions you've had with people that you disagree with that arise in your book, by the way. And, you know, Ben Radford isn't the only one. We do see, of course, also long dialogues you've had with Rupert Sheldrake, who's been attacked in this very way. The famous experiment that Sheldrake was involved with, which of course had to do with dogs being able to predict. Dogs that know, I think, is that what it was called?
Yes, dogs that know when their owners are coming home.
Yes, you know, James Randi even had claimed, as well as I believe Richard Wiseman, I believe had been the one who had said that this, of course, was entirely bunk and could be disproven. Recently, in advance of the release of this documentary that featured James Randi, I believe it's called An Honest Liar, Randi had basically had to say that, well, maybe he didn't quite have the data that he claimed he had once had in support of Sheldrake's research being bunk. Now, you've spent a lot of time talking with Rupert Sheldrake. Transcriptions of some of those discussions appear in your book. What are your general feelings about not only the experiment, but also Sheldrake's treatment by the modern skeptical community in relation to that?
Well, the whole experience was very eye-opening to me, Micah, because I really did go into this skeptico experience that I've had over the last 7 years with a much more welcoming attitude towards skeptics. I mean, let's face it, you know, you take that that skeptical vibe, and there's some really cool parts about that. At least to thoughtful people like you and I who really like getting at the facts, you're like, hey, here's some people who really are brave enough to stand up against, you know, conventional wisdom and stand up against the fraudsters and smoke out the data, you know, and that's what we want, right? We want someone who's willing to smoke out the data. So I was open to that. But I was also intrigued by just the intelligence and the seeming fair-mindedness of folks like biologist Rupert Sheldrake, who you mentioned. Smart guy, you know, you talk to him. Cambridge biologist, has that great British accent that we all love over here in the States and we think sounds so smart. But he is a guy who backs it up. He is smart. And the experiment is kind of intriguing, too. I don't know if you've had much experience with dogs, but wife is an absolute dog lover. We've fostered over 40 dogs in our family.
Oh, bless your heart.
And they're always coming and going, and we got a beautiful boxer out there that's just beautiful, that's been with us for a couple of weeks, and he's a real piece of work. But the being around dogs, you notice that they're kind of amazing creatures in a lot of ways. And Sheldrake, because he's a biologist and because he's somewhat of a dog lover, got interested in these reports of people saying, you know what, it's unexplainable, but my dog seems to know when I'm coming home. And not in an ordinary way, like, you know, he's barking at the door or anything. People would say, like, hey, I'm a plumber, you know, and I come home at all different times during the day. And my wife says, oh, I don't, this is before cell phones, you know, there's no need to call or anything like that. I know 15 minutes before you come home because our dog goes and sits right by the door. I mean, like clockwork, 15 minutes, no matter what time you're coming home. And then there's fantastic reports of people who've been, you know, away in the army and they come home after a year and a half, and the dog, you know, a half hour before is like running down a mile to the bus stop, you know, over and over. He's getting a ton of these reports, which, again, if you're not knowledgeable about how science works, and then somebody comes along and goes, oh, well, those are anecdotal. Well, let me tell you, folks, that kind of natural history is what real scientists use as the first step to begin a formal inquiry into a topic like this. So you get a biologist, he starts collecting all these stories, and he says, hey, there's something here I need to investigate. And that's exactly what happened with Sheldrake. So he set up a test, and if you think it through and you have a couple of video cameras, this is a pretty easy test to do. You videotape the owner, you videotape the dog, you send the owner out in a taxi, you call him up at some random time, say, come home, and you see what the dog does, right? Mm-hmm. Sheldrake did this experiment. He did it over and over again, over 200 trials. And he found out that the dog, while the owner was coming home, went to the window or did this anticipation behavior about 78% of the time. Now, this is just off the charts extraordinary, because the amount of time that the dog went to the window just because there was another dog passing by or just because that was their normal path was dramatically lower than that. Dramatically lower. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was like 15% or something like that. So 15% versus 78%. You do that 200 trials, you have a hugely statistically significant result. Well, that's really the research. What makes it a juicy story is what you talked about or alluded to, Micah, is you had this guy, Richard Wiseman, who's also in the UK and is a rather famous debunker, who came along, borrowed Sheldrake's video camera, borrowed Sheldrake's setup because a TV station had invited him. And as you know, you've seen this a million times, right? We need to balance this out. Let's get a skeptic in here. So they haul in Wiseman. Wiseman runs four trials, changes the rules, and says, what? We're not looking for the time, the amount of time that the dog spends by the window. I mean, just let me think about it. That's the most straightforward way to do it. You know, the amount of time that the dog spends by the window while the owner comes home should be the measure. No, Wiseman invents this protocol that says, if the dog goes to the window and stays for 2 minutes, then that's considered waiting. Otherwise, it's not considered waiting. Well, Sheldrake just threw a fit. He's like, you know, look, because I'm skipping the then Wiseman came out. The dog didn't, over these four trials, the dog didn't do that 2 minute thing. And Wiseman just is incredibly adept at manipulating the media, or manipulating might be a loaded word, but at, I don't know, being savvy in utilizing the media.
Sure.
And he got his story out there all over the place. He went even got a paper published, all this stuff that he had debunked the Dogs That Know experiment. And he wrote a book that kind of portrayed him as the guy who really pioneered this work and all this. Well, the final upshot to this story, Micah, is that Sheldrick went back and reanalyzed Wiseman's four trials, mind you, four trials versus 200. But he reanalyzed the time trials in the four trials, and they were even more statistically significant than Sheldrick's in terms of the amount of time that the dog spent waiting while the owner was coming home versus the time that he spent waiting when the owner wasn't coming home. So it's a tale with a lot of different aspects to it. It one definitely shows some kind of unexplainable link between people who really have this connection with their dogs, and it also shows how desperately messed up science can be when data contradicts with the kind of orthodoxy or the established known truth about things.
Fascinating stuff. Alex Sakiris is our guest tonight. His book is Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. I want to just cite something that appears on page 37 in that book, a similar statement to what we were just discussing, made by Dr. Carolyn Watt, who had noted of a peer-reviewed paper that she had co-authored. She says it was intended to be a provocative piece. It's not claiming to be balanced. Now, interesting, if you're going to seek peer review for a paper you've written, I think the last thing you'd want to do is merely be provocative and not be balanced. That's apparently exactly what she said. You know, maybe we'll talk with Alex about that when we come back. I also want to get into some consciousness studies here on the Grayling Report. We'll be back right in a moment. The high mountains of Appalachia. Welcome back. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report, keeping you company from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time on the one and only worldwide Global Radio Alliance, KGRIRadio.com. Of course, we're discussing the book Why Science is Wrong with Alex Sakiris tonight, and I sincerely hope, Alex, that I'm still managing to pronounce your name correctly.
No, as I was telling you before the show, you got it spot on. You sound like a Greek guy or something. But right. I before getting any further, yeah. Mickey, you got me jabbering away here, and I got so many questions for you because I'm a podcaster and I like to ask questions. So we're going to continue, but man, you got to promise me you're going to come on Skeptico because you have so many cool ideas and things that I want to kind of push you on in a Skeptico way too. So will you do that? Will you come on Skeptico with me?
Absolutely, absolutely. And let that be known, since we're talking about it here in a live format, that is, I'm agreeing to do that with you at any time. Would love to come on the program and talk. You know, I'm sure you and I'll be in touch a lot following this this inaugural discussion that we'll share here. So yeah, anytime you name the time, I'll be there and be glad to do so.
Cool, because I really think you've really pushed things in such an interesting and such an interesting direction with your ideas about consciousness and UFOs, and I think we could really have a good exchange on that. So we're going to make that happen, and there's other topics I'm sure we can talk about too. So we'll just tee that up.
Absolutely, absolutely. But if you don't mind, while we're on that discussion, you know, again, UFOs, honestly, they aren't the first thing I think of. When I look at your website, I think about Skeptico. But since you bring it up, I'd like to ask your opinions just as well. Consciousness, I know, I think is at the root of all of this. But as it relates to a subject like UFOs, we obviously have a lot of issues. And my skepticism, of course, is, I don't like to use the term hardened, but I think that it is certainly, I've grown to what I feel is a fundamentally more skeptical place of mind in relation to my own perception of UFO phenomena over the years. But there's, I think, without question, a component to it that has everything to do with the mysteries of consciousness and the way that we perceive reality. But what are your thoughts in relation to essentially UFOs, and do you think that there is a connection there, or is there a great divide between the supposedly technological presence of some strange exotic things in our skies and then the great mystery of consciousness?
I think there's definitely a connection, but I think it could be possibly different than the way that we think, because, you know, I was doing a pretty good job earlier of bashing this mind equals brain materialism that I think fails on any number of fronts experimentally. It not only fails philosophically, but we could go through, you know, self-directed neuroplasticity, hypnosis, placebo. There's a number of things that point in this direction. And then, of course, the death knell to mind equals brain is near-death experience science, where these guys in hospital have seen people die. And you were mentioning, you know, the oxygen to the brain stuff. All that has been completely and thoroughly addressed and is off the table in terms of a possible explanation. So there's quite a bit of science there that suggests, although we cannot explain it, these people seem to be having conscious experiences, that's the extension of consciousness, after a time when their brain is at the very least impaired beyond our understanding of how there could be anything like a conscious experience, right? So if you want to get really technical and quibble with whether that was a dead brain or not, first you'd go to a really well-trained physician like Sam Parnia, who is one of the worldwide leaders in resuscitation, formerly at Cornell and now at University of New York, Stony Brook, one of the worldwide most recognized people in resuscitation. So he is constantly asking that question, is somebody dead? Are they not dead? How can we bring them back from dead? And he will tell you, because he's also a near-death experience researcher, that these people are dead. Yeah. These people are what we call dead. They are brain dead. Their brain, even if there's some super low level, that is not anything we've ever associated with through all these tests we've done on EEGs of people and of animals with having any kind of activity that was correlated with consciousness. So these people are dead, and yet they're still having a conscious experience, and that completely ends the mind equal brain. But that was a long digression from the UFO question. But here's the link. Once you get there and you say, okay, I have to accept that mind equal brain is off the table and that somehow consciousness extends beyond death, this extended consciousness thing, which a lot of people in the UFO community are starting to open up to and saying, okay, could that be over here in these ghost apparition phenomena? Could it be over here? Could it be in the ayahuasca experience? You know, could it be the alien encounter experience? Well, yeah, it could be, but the water gets very murky. So the nice thing about the materialistic mind equal brain thing is things are pretty easy. When we get away from that, things are not so easy. What is life after death? What is heaven? Is there such a heaven? Is Jesus there? Is Allah there? What, you know, all that stuff comes on the table, and it's really hard to sort through. And I think it's equally hard to sort through what that might mean for these beings that people are encountering sometimes, you know, in these reports, in these UFO reports, in these abduction reports. You know, one little foray that I have had into this field that I'd love to chat with you about sometime is, you know, I interviewed David Jacobs, actually interviewed him twice. Hmm. And I know he's just hated among some groups because of the whole Emma Woods thing and all that. But that aside, I found another reason to engage with him on this question of abduction and hypnosis and what information can be gained. And I juxtaposed that interview with two interviews I did with a woman from Australia named Mary Rodwell, who also does hypnotic regression and does this help people retrieve memories of what they claim are alien abductions. So I got into that quite thoroughly, and it's something we could really probably have a good hour-long discussion on. And I know there's a lot of listeners to the Graylin Report who have a lot of opinions on that. And, I'd love to kind of delve into that sometime.
Yeah, we certainly should, you know, and if nothing else in my mind, which I think there are probably a lot of different ways it could go, but, you know, at the very least, one that certainly comes to mind is the similarity between certain experiences. There was a scientific paper actually that I found years ago, and I'll have to try and find that so that I can cite the actual source of the study. But it dealt with any variety of altered states of consciousness. NDEs, you know, out of body experiences. There a lot of these cases. And you may have come across this study, Alex, but they looked at situations where someone had been beaten, deprived, you know, being held hostage, you know, people in what were considered high-risk situations or situations that threatened an individual to the extent that it seemed to be conducive to an altered state of consciousness being entered. But the study did look at not only instances where, for instance, I think one of the people was sitting in a warehouse being held hostage. They'd been mistreated, and at one point they had an out-of-body experience, stepped outside their own body and looked at themselves and all these kind of things. There are numerous things like that cited. But interestingly, there's also a purported alien abduction that's mentioned. And the purpose of the paper wasn't to try and justify the claims of the abduction, you know, which, again, I think I'm more than willing to discuss any number of phenomena. But I think that at times we do have to draw lines between them and look at them, you know, unto themselves before we start saying it's all one big thing. Maybe they all are, who knows? But I've over time looked more, I guess, at the individual phenomena. And this study was extremely interesting, noting in this instance the similarities between different varieties of altered states of consciousness. I actually talked about that in Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, and that's one thing that I think is so often overlooked is the commonality between these experiences. Do you find that in your own research and in your own scope of examining across the board with all the different people that on the Skeptico podcast and on your website and your book, you know, all the different individuals from different walks of life that you talk with, do you notice a certain commonality between experiences?
I think you bring up a really interesting point, and it's one of those that, like I was just alluding to, where it gets really, really murky because, you know, so commonality, right? Yes. What about differences, though, even within a certain kind of experience? You know, take the near-death experience, right? So there's a lot of folks that want to jump on the NDE bandwagon, and I even had a couple on who were, you know, very orthodox conservative Christians and wanted to claim, there's this kind of movement among some Christians to claim the near-death experience as a Christian kind of experience, which the data clearly suggests it is not, right? So yeah. It is really in a lot of ways in conflict with traditional Christian doctrine, you know, in a number of ways that we don't even have to get into. But clearly people see Jesus. That's a fact. People see Allah, see Buddha, see other just beings of light or the being of light that they identify with God. But the people don't see black, see a void, see darkness. So so what you're saying, you know, is a really interesting point, Micah, is, you know, what is the similarity of these experiences across all of them? But then you can take any one kind of experience that we've induced the same way. Like in this case, we haven't induced it, but it has been induced by cardiac arrest because most of the clinical trials of, or the clinical experiments that are reported on near-death experience are done in cardiac arrest boards because it controls the physiological variables, you know? I mean, like, people can have a near-death experience if they're drowning. They can have one if they think the plane is crashing. Even if they're not physically threatened, they can have a near-death experience. But traditionally, scientists have studied near-death experience in the cardiac arrest board because they can say, oh, that person had a heart attack. So therefore, we know 15 seconds later, there was no blood flow to the brain. The brain shut down. They can then go ahead and kind of make reasonable assumptions about the physiology of that person, and that's helpful, as you can understand, from a science standpoint.
Sure,
but it doesn't take away from the fact that these reports are all over the board in terms of what these people are seeing. What the heck does that mean?
Yeah, I guess, you know, one interpretation would be that the variety of experiences is indicative of the fact that, well, this is within the mind. But you know, again, I don't know that necessarily that's the case. And, you know, I think a lot of people get burnt out with me trying to, I think they perceive I play to both sides. That's not the the objective here, just to make everybody happy. The point is to try not to come to a rash judgment based on something, A, that I haven't experienced, B, that I don't think that we have a full data set to accompany, you know, and see something that indeed, like you've pointed out, numerous people around the world seem to experience. Now, the variety, I think, probably does have some to do with culture and cultural differences. Like you say, some people see Jesus, some people see Buddha, some people see Allah. You know, obviously culture influences these experiences. Some of the DMT studies that Rick Strassman did, you know, that is some fascinating stuff. And obviously to me, culture influences all of this, but that doesn't necessarily support an attitude that it's all just made up experiences or just perception of something interpreted through the lens of a religious, or if not a religious, at least a spiritual longing for something more than what happens upon bodily death.
Well, but the other thing we have to do, Micah, and this is like a big part of my book, Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything, and it's because it took me a long time of kind of stumbling in the dark to kind of see this, and it's a very simple idea, mm-hmm. but all bets are off when mind doesn't equal brain. So like even you slipped in there and said, it's a product of the mind. Well, it may be if we're now extending the mind to something that exists outside of your body.
Right.
But clearly what the near-death experience science tells us is these people didn't have a brain. They didn't have a functioning brain that produces mind in any way that we normally associate it with. They were also, remember, in the near-death experience, by now almost everyone is familiar with it, mm-hmm. they are outside of their body. Now this they've verified, right? So people are outside of their body looking down. How are you outside of your body looking down? We don't have a mechanism for that. And yet they're reporting, you know, the color of the socks of the intern who's pushing the resuscitation cart in from the other room. How do you know this? How can people hear things when their ears are taped over and they're all these things? So the traditional, we have to be careful because when we say even culture, you know, okay,
sure.
Culture, but this is a culture now that is beyond our bodily life, you know? So how does it tie into the reincarnation research, you know? I mean, I saw you did a piece, a great piece. I thought you covered it very nicely, of Ryan, the boy, studied by Dr. Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia, right? Remember that one you just did a couple weeks ago?
Yeah.
And so Jim Tucker's been on the show, interviewed him, great guy. As you kind of reported in that case, and there's no real rational way to kind of explain how these 56 just stunning facts could be known unless you're willing to extend consciousness beyond this kind of narrow way where we've blocked it in with science that says, you know, consciousness ends at your death. Now, notice they never say when consciousness begins because they never handled that. They never say what's necessary and sufficient to cause consciousness, they being science, that is. But yet they're going to postulate that, well, we know right here where it ends at death.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I would even, glad you brought that up, by the way, because I would look at the mystery of consciousness. We often try to kind of, I don't know, we kind of try to triangulate that within the scope of the purported out-of-body experience that occurs often in conjunction with a near-death experience. I think could really draw a pretty clear distinction between the two, because there are people who claim that they leave their bodies temporarily without coming close to death, without some sort of a shock or some sort of a seizure or some sort of a critical injury. But often the out-of-body experience accompanies the NDE as defined by Raymond Moody. Now, what's interesting, I think, is with reincarnation claims. And you noted, I think, 56, 57 points just about that young boy Ryan's case that Dr. Jim Tucker had cataloged. But he's dealt with, what, more than, what, 200, 250 cases?
Yeah, 2,000 they have in the files there.
Really? Okay, yeah. I was way off. Okay, by a few hundred, a few orders of magnitude. But anyway, the point is that, with those reincarnation cases, we actually have, rather than the localized experience with a person who claims to leave their body, a person who claims not only to have left a body, but carried certain aspects in regard to memory over to another existence, which, there are a number of ways we could interpret the modality behind that, but really it does seem to begin to make a case for something like you have argued in your book and throughout this discussion, that is a non-local orientation for mind or for consciousness, rather than merely within the brain. We've only got a couple more minutes, but Alex, I want to say this has been so much fun. Closing thoughts, first of all, the floor is yours, and also, where can people find you online and find your book?
Closing thoughts, I wanted to add to that discussion we were just having. The closing thoughts were, if you can get to that non-local mind, reincarnation, life after death, UFOs and aliens from another planet are trivial, man. It's no big deal.
That's true.
So skeptico.com, spell it with a K, and check out the book, find it on Amazon, anywhere else. We're going to continue this conversation, so I'll just say goodbye for now, and it's been great talking to you.
For now, and that's all I'll allow you, because yes, indeed, we'll be in touch. And matter of fact, with or without there being a live audience listening, we'll have to stay in touch, Alex. I've truly enjoyed the conversation. I wished you all the best, and I hope, of course, that you'll continue asking all those good questions that you do, the hard ones, sometimes the troubling ones, but the necessary ones, okay?
All right, Mike, I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. Thank you. That's Alex Sarkaris. His book, of course, is Why Science is Wrong About Almost Everything. He raises some very interesting points, and I think, asks a lot of difficult questions that a lot of us have been wondering for quite some time now. I know I have, and we'll continue that dialogue with him in the future. That's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Hey, do check us out online at www.graylianreport.com. I've told you all about all the wonderful stuff that we have there. Lots to look at. Indeed, and lots to think about. Hey, if you've got thoughts or ideas that you'd like to share with me or Caleb or any of the Graylian gang or one of our guests, I invite you to send me an email, info@graylianreport.com, anytime, any place. Those emails will come to me. Now, I apologize. I don't get to answer every email. I try to. We had a whole listener email section that we didn't get to tonight on this show, let alone a number of news stories. But you can get a lot of the news that we would have discussed tonight had we had the time at GraylianReport.com, and of course also in our subscriber area at GraylianReport.com/X. A whole nother podcast, as well as Graylian Enigmas, a crypto show, and much, much more. On behalf of yours truly, Micah Hanks, along with Caleb Hanks, Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Jim Harold, and of course Race and Robin Hobbs and Master Control, Jeremy London, all the fine folks here that help us, we bid you adieu, and until next time, stay strange.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.